Thank you, everybody, for attending session 235, titled The Role of Reason in the Transformation of the RLDS Church to the Community of Christ. Before we begin today, we have a few announcements. We ask that you please turn off your cell phones or silence them, and that those attending today will be respectful and attentive. The session is, of course, being recorded, and you'll be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. If you have not already, please consider subscribing to Sunstone Magazine and podcast at the registration desk as well. Concessions will be open in the venue for lunch, or you're welcome to visit local restaurants in the area. That's the next part of our agenda today, is the lunch hour. But please return by 1:45 to get your seat for the next session. This session is 60 minutes long, and we both ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework of that time so that we can allow you ample time for lunch and for the next session to start on time. As you can see from your programs, the program description is as follows. The RLDS Church went through the process of transitioning itself from sect to denomination over the past half century or so. Two causes often cited are the increase in graduate education and the effect of missionary work in non-Christian nations. This paper will contend that the life of the mind is the primary reason for the theological divide, and the Wesleyan quadrilateral is a useful tool in the pursuit of religious truth. Bill Russell, our presenter, is Professor Emeritus of American History and Government at Graceland University in Lamoni, Iowa. He is a past president of the Mormon History Association and the John Whitmer Historical Association. He's widely published in Mormon studies, including his most recent book, Homosexual Saints, The Community of Christ Experience. And above all, he is a proud Porter Rockwell donor to Sunstone. And now we turn the time over to Bill for the presentation.
They leave that last line out when I speak at Mormon History Association about the Porter Rockwell thing. Okay, now like most kids growing up in my church, formerly the RLDS Church, I hated it when friends asked me what church I belonged to. And I would have to give this long name, the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. We're not the Mormons. Well, when significant changes began to occur in the theology of the church beginning in the 1960s, it happened that key people in the church were questioning some of our beliefs, no longer thinking our church had the whole truth. For the RLDS Church, that truth had been established by Joseph Smith Jr. and was formulated in Smith's early years as prophet up through the Kirtland period. But then somewhere along that line, that Brigham Young and those saints who went back west distorted the truths that existed, and Brigham promulgated heretical new doctrines and practices like polygamy, the plurality of gods, baptism of the dead, and secret temple rituals. After World War II, we began to have members doing graduate work in history and other disciplines, people like Bob Flanders, Emma Blair, Richard Howard, Barbara Higdon, and Paul Edwards. And we had to finally, very reluctantly, had to admit, well, that Joseph Smith himself, not that Brigham Young guy, established those abominable doctrines. So it's a terrible thing to happen. The division of opinion between these new scholars in the church and those who held fast to the traditional views came to a head in 1984 when World Conference delegates approved President Walt B. Smith's revelation supporting the ordination of women. I've cut a lot of this out because I've like to leave plenty of time for discussion. Lloyd Young, who was a religion professor and my academic advisor my junior and senior years at Graceland, we exchanged a lot of emails the last few years of his life. He died about 10 years ago. In one email, Lloyd said that he thought the major difference between liberals and fundamentalists on religion was that liberals gave more room for reason for the mind. Now I'm going to look at various issues in RLDS thought, which we found inadequate, and I have studied these traditions over the years, the use of reason rather than just relying on proof texts from the Bible or Book of Mormon or wherever, helped us rethink some of our traditional beliefs. So here are my top 10 issues. Number 10, can the Bible be interpreted literally? The historical study of the Bible, you know, some of these pages are stick together, probably shouldn't chew tobacco while you're reading the paper. The historical study of the Bible, usually called biblical criticism, originated in German universities in the late 18th century and have become well known in England in the early 19th century, but didn't get very well known in the USA until about 1880 to 1900. So I did a study of the RLDS reaction to biblical criticism in that period, 1880 to 1900. Clearly, we didn't like it. And that wasn't surprising. Joseph Smith's prophetic career was in the 1830s and early 1840s, and some of his revelations assumed the literal interpretation of religious doctrine. But, yeah. So in the mid 20th century, some RLDS church writers began to cautiously use biblical criticism in their writings about the Bible. In the 1940s, we had Dr. Chaville's The Bible and Everyday Living, and F. Henry Edwards's The Life and Ministry of Jesus. They cautiously used some of this biblical criticism. Probably the clearest example was Clifford Cole. He published a book in 1954, called The Prophets Speak. And he wanted to counter the tendency among some church members to regard Old Testament prophets as men who were directly addressing conditions in the 20th century America. That sounds kind of absurd, doesn't it? You know, these 8th century prophets were trying to direct their message to you and me and not folks that he lived with. And so the Department of Religious Education, they began to develop a series of 4 Sunday school quarterlies for high school youth. This is in 1960 and 61. They developed a higher critical model for approaching various stories of the Old Testament. These stories brought the traditional literal interpretation in direct conflict with the new historical methods for understanding biblical writings. Some examples are the matter of biological evolution and understanding the age of the earth. A literal understanding of the early history leads to a 6-day creation of the earth by Yahweh in about 4004 BC. I think it was in October, kind of late October. They got very precise on
21st.
It. Oh, it's the 21st, okay. And then some of those people in those early years lived as long as 900 years. I mean, we need to find out their dietary secrets. These Sunday school quarterlies became very controversial. Some jurisdictions in the churches mailed it back to independents, and it wouldn't happen. One of my favorites is the story of Jonah surviving 3 days in the whale. The literal view completely ruins the point of a good story that has a very important point. Here you've got this reluctant missionary. He's directed to go to Nineveh and preach to those people he hated. And damn it, they all get converted. And so he sits on the bank and sulks because all these people that he hated are now have been converted by his reluctance and missionary work. I kind of doubt that happened, you know, but that's a great story. A special concern for those of us in the Latter-day Saint tradition was, I'll just go really quickly through this, and that is Deutero-Isaiah. Major parts of Isaiah, the latter part, were published about 150 years after Isaiah of Jerusalem lived, and that period is the time of Cyrus, which the book of Isaiah mentions, and it's just a whole different context, a whole different literary style, a whole different theology of the first Isaiah and the second Isaiah, which of course raises important points for the Book of Mormon. Joseph Smith was very fond of Isaiah, apparently, and he had about umpteen chapters of Isaiah in the Book of Mormon. For some strange reason, the problem of biblical criticism, which bothers me the most, is treating Adam as a real character in history, along with Eve and the other people in chapters 1 to 11 of Genesis. I see no reason to treat Adam and other characters in the first 11 chapters as anything other than an attempt to explain the origin of our world, and especially the origins of the human beings. Now, why is it that Adam is never mentioned in the rest of the Old Testament? It's because he didn't exist. That's a simple fact. But he didn't. All the evidence supports the fact that he is a fictitious character, and a very interesting fictitious character, but a fictitious character. There was considerable negative reaction to these high school quarterlies. I guess I told you that. I believe this was the first big controversy in 1960-61 over those high school quarterlies that became very visible and led to many other controversies that came down the line later. Number nine. Is the Book of Mormon a historical document? Eventually, the question, is the Book of Mormon a historical document, would rear its ugly head after all this biblical criticism was going on in the church. In my view, it clearly isn't historical. The author reflects the religious concerns of the burned-over district of Western New York. Historians read who are outside the faith, read the book, and it fits in the period of Joseph Smith's life. The author of the Book of Mormon is a fellow named Joseph Smith. The first significant document authored by a church member which challenged the historicity of the Book of Mormon was written by Wayne Ham, a very bright young scholar in the Department of Religious Education, and this is published in 1970. The department was preparing to develop new Sunday school materials for the church, and the old materials reflected too much of the old non-biblical critical view and so forth. Ham's paper in 1970 cited nine reasons the Book of Mormon should not be seen as a historical document. They were the problem of its coming forth. Is this microphone working? Can you hear me all right? Okay. I'll just try holding it. I can't use that one hand. I'm not free, but I'll try it. The problem of its coming forth is number one. Number two, identifying the book's narrative with a particular setting and time and place. Where did this thing happen? Number three, the book's propensity for reflecting in detail the religious concerns of the American frontier. Number four, the Christological perspective of the book. Number five, the book's ethical implications when viewed as universally binding upon all people. Number six, the use of biblical scripture and ideas as sources. Number seven, Isaiah in the Book of Mormon. And number eight, the matter of Book of Mormon anachronisms. And number nine, the changes in the Book of Mormon, the thousands of changes made later. When I taught the Book of Mormon class at Grayson about five times, I always had them read the 1830 edition. As a historian, I like them to read them in the original. Ham's position on the Book of Mormon was not shared by many other active church members at the time. But over the next 50 years, there was a gradual change in thinking by some people in the church. But still, I'm sure, for a long time, and maybe still, there's a majority of people in the church who do see the Book of Mormon as historical. The first significant document authored by a church member... I flipped that page wrong. I need to have a wider podium up here. I devoted my presidential addresses for both the MHA and the JWHA to the historicity of the Book of Mormon. In 1977, I was the president of the John Whitmer Historical Association, and my presidential address compared the religious thought of ancient Israel at 600 BC, when Lehi and family allegedly departed for the Americas, and compared it to the thought of Protestant American Christians in the USA at the time the Book of Mormon was published. I found significant differences in the thought of the two cultures. 5 years later, in 1982, I gave a paper at the Mormon History Association meeting in Ogden, in which I concluded that the Book of Mormon was not historical. The following year, I was president of the Mormon History Association, and I gave a paper in which I indicated how the study of history has significantly changed my views on all three of our standard books, the Joseph Smith translation of the Bible, the Book of Mormon, and the RLDS version of the Bible. I'm sorry, of the Doctrine and Covenants. I felt like the one half of the people in the audience appreciated my paper, and clearly about one half did not appreciate it at all. At the and so at that MHA meeting in 1983, you can say the opinion was mixed. One elderly couple, really cute, they came forward to me to thank me. The gentleman said his wife, she apparently didn't want to talk, but his wife said she was so happy to be here because I'd been saying just exactly what she's been thinking for many years. And so that was just a thrill to her. On the other hand, one person whose happiness was short of ecstasy was Lou Midgley, philosophy professor at BYU. It took him only 26 pages to adequately express his displeasure with my paper. And I got three or four more such letters from Lou. We finally became friends and exchanged one-page letters. Okay, number 8. Should the church canonize the prophet's revelations? In the Bible, of course, as I took at St. Paul's School of Theology, the nearby Methodist seminary in Kansas City, I had found especially interesting the readings on the canonization of the Old and New Testaments. The thing that struck me about this was that both the Old and New Testaments were canonized over long periods of time and not by some formal process and not by a very quick process. We had our church canonizing the Doctrine and Covenants. We had what I call instant canonization. I mean, sometimes at World Conference, the president would bring a potential revelation to the conference in the morning and have the quorums discuss it and so forth, have a general discussion in the afternoon, and then they'd vote. And like by 5 o'clock, we had some new scripture. We hadn't even seen it in writing yet. You know, we'd only heard it read a couple of times, and it just made absolutely no sense. And compared to the biblical process, which took a long period of time, and those documents worked well, met the needs of the people of the community, and so they finally were accepted as scripture. One embarrassing situation arose in 1982 when some delegates wanted to put Mark Hoffman's forgery calling for Joseph Smith III to be his successor, wanted to put it in the Doctrine and Covenants, the main body of the Doctrine and Covenants. Well, it was proposed by somebody who made a substitute motion. Well, let's just put it in the appendix of the Doctrine and Covenants, where we have these three revelations on baptism of the dead, which we don't like and we want to get rid of, so we put them in the appendix. Well, let's add it to the appendix. So that seemed to be very helpful. But then it was kind of embarrassing when it turned out a couple years later it was a forgery. Well, now I want to be very clear about this. We in the community of Christ do not put forgeries in the main body of the Doctrine and Covenants. They've got to go in the appendix. We have standards that we apply. Okay. Now let's look at the... I missed the question. The question on did we establish a church? I must be missing a page here, but I think I can wing it. So the problem is, I grew up in a church, and I'm not sure about how the LDS handled this, but I grew up in a church where missionaries would come and say, "Now we have the true church, and the way we prove that is we have Jesus' organization of the true church." And then you'd see quotations from the scriptures. One line from somewhere mentions deacon, another line somewhere mentions teacher, another line mentions elder. And yeah, there's also that 70 in chapter 17 of Luke. And there's the high priest in Hebrews. We didn't seem to realize that the high priest in Hebrews was the one high priest who was in charge of the sacrificial system at the temple. Now, we had 1,000 high priests by then, and you guys probably had 1,000,000 of them. I don't know. But clearly Jesus didn't establish a church. He wasn't a community organizer or the organizer of an organization. That happened a generation or more later in the church, and we established a normal priesthood of deacon, elder, and bishop, not all these others, many of which don't occur in the New Testament as members, as priests in the Christian tradition. The high priest thing is especially funny. I had a couple of theology professors. I happened to land in the lunch line with them one day at St. Paul, the Methodist Seminary. And we got to talking, and then pretty soon Professor Dunlap said to me, "Well, Bill, where is the RLDS Church headquarters at?" It's very easy to explain, so I gave him the directions. And while I was explaining, the other guy, Paul Jones, who was brand new that year at St. Paul, he kind of turned the other way because this isn't his discussion, you know. So Dunlap asked me, "Well, now, what group is it that I'm speaking to tomorrow night?" And I said, "The high priest." And Jones whirls around, says, "The high priest?" He just couldn't believe it. And Dunlap, real nervously, said, "Maybe I'm going to be the sacrifice." So anyway, but he was. I'm glad to report that he was not the sacrifice. So Jesus, actually, was a charismatic leader. He's not an organizer and so forth. The Latter-day Saint priesthood was a creative priesthood system developed by Joseph Smith in the 19th century. We don't have to try to push it back into the first century. We can just say Joseph had quite a creative, and we can make an argument, you know, okay, a case for whatever ones of the priesthood offices we think are very important. I mean, I would certainly narrow the number very, very much, but certainly it's a 19th century system. Of course, you know, with the Aaronic and Melchizedek priesthood. Now, where Joseph got the Melchizedek thing, God only knows, and she ain't telling. So, number six, was there a dark ages when divine authority was absent from the earth? I recall missionaries telling us about the apostasy of the middle ages and that God had withdrawn his authority from the church because it was so sinful. And of course, there was no authority until a farm boy from New York in 1830 restored the Church of Christ with all that authority. Now, if you want to date the beginning of an apostasy, it seems to me the most logical place to start is Constantine, when he embraced Christianity made it the imperial religion about 330. That always makes when the king, the emperor, as a Christian, that always makes good possibility for corruption, which plenty of it came along. If you read classic textbooks on the history of Christianity, like Kenneth Scott Latterett or Willison Walker, you will discover that throughout those dark ages, there were periods of spiritual vitality followed by periods of stagnation and corruption, followed by another period of spiritual vitality and another period of corruption back and forth. But there were great Christian theologians, priests, and mystics in the Middle Ages. It is similar to the periods of revival and reform following the periods of corruption we find in the Book of Judges, as well as in the Book of Mormon. Graceland's Dr. Roy Chaville recognized a major problem in our church's understanding of Christian history. So he published a book called Did the Light Go Out? He concluded that there were plenty of signs of spiritual vitality during what had been falsely called the Dark Ages. In the foreword of the book, Chaville writes, "I was told that the year AD 570 marked the coming of the apostasy, or departure from the light of the Christian gospel." He continued, "An interpretation of Revelation, chapter 12, verse 14, had suggested the number 1260, which subtracted from AD 1830, when Joseph founded the church, gives you the year 570. Now, the heart of these 160 years is called the Dark Ages. Well, it's kind of difficult. What can come up with in 570 that is a showing of the great apostasy of the Catholic Church? We had missionaries, elders who tried publishing books proving that, but absolutely without any light. So Chaville's book, Did the Light Go Out? He says, "At no time did the light go out," is his conclusion. And I was really pleased to see him do that, because his two semester history of Christianity was probably the most valuable course I took as a religion major at Graceland. Number five, did Joseph Smith engage in polygamy? We RLDS had a serious problem dealing with polygamy. We were clearly opposed to it from the beginning, and I think it was our major issue with those saints out west led by Brother Brigham. Understandably, young Joseph III didn't want to think that his father had been a polygamist, and of course his mother, Emma, wasn't about to admit it, if indeed she was aware of it, which I think she was, as Val and Linda in their biography show. So Joseph III was very careful to give the impression that his father was a monogamist. And as the older men in the earliest church died off, those that being the men who would more likely remember things about Joseph and polygamy, then Joseph III became a little bit more assertive that his father was most definitely not a polygamist. And of course, Emma, in her last testimony, in 1878, the year she died, said that Joseph was not a polygamist. She was being interviewed by her son, the president of the RLDS Church. Now, we've always claimed that that was proof Joseph was a monogamist. But my point is, what else could Emma say? Her son was the president of the RLDS Church, the anti-polygamy church. She had two other sons that were members of the First Presidency at various times in their career. 19 years have gone by now since her son had become president of the RLDS Church. They're doing pretty well. What else could a mother say in that situation, given her view and given her son's strong fight against polygamy, including going to Utah and allegedly uncovering evidence of his father's not being a polygamist? So Joseph III had sons who were church presidents until 1978. They all strongly denied their grandfather, Joseph the Martyr, was ever a polygamist. But opinion in the church began to show change when Robert Bruce Flanders, a professor of American history at Grayson College, decided to write his PhD dissertation at the University of Wisconsin on the Mormon community in Nauvoo. It appears that Flanders did not really realize what a minefield he was running into. He was a good elder, practicing elder in the church and so forth. But clearly Joseph was a polygamist. Flanders found all kinds of evidence of that. And so he issued his dissertation, and it was proved. And there it was. Well, the First Presidency of the church realized that Flanders' book was going to be pretty controversial, so they decided to have lunch with Paul Wellington, the editor of the Herald, office next door to me. So the parking lot was just outside our offices. So the First Presidency drove up to the window, by our windows, and Paul went out and got in the car, and they went to have lunch to talk about Flanders' book. So they told Paul, well, we're concerned about Bob Flanders' book. Should we have a review of it in the Herald? Well, Paul Wellington said, the review is running on the press right now. Because Paul had called me 2 weeks earlier and said, I was the editor of the book reviews. Care for a review of Flanders' book? I said, sure. Paul sent it. We published it. It's running in the presses. Now the presidency is asking Paul Wellington, should we review the book? It seems like the car returned after a fairly brief lunch, although I'm not sure. Flanders really begins the process of our church facing up to the serious nature of our claims about Joseph as a polygamist. Flanders was really shocked about some of the things that went on. He had Alan Tyree, a future apostle and future member of the First Presidency, apparently read the book, and he came up to Graceland and just really chewed Bob Flanders out. And Bob had he wasn't a real courageous guy. I mean, his feelings were hurt fairly easily, and they were really hurt. And then we had members of the church who never read the book, like my mother and probably my grandfather, who were just sure that Joseph was not a polygamist because Joseph III said he wasn't. And my grandfather heard it directly from Joseph III's mouth, so that's all my mother needed to know, that he clearly was not a polygamist. And so Flanders was really hurt by all that. And within a few years, he just departed from the RLDS Church. But it was an academic book published by the University Press, so church members could kind of dismiss it. But 19 years later, in 1983, church historian Dick Howard published an article in the John Whitmer Historical Association Journal, which he gently suggested that perhaps Joseph Smith might have been involved in polygamy and that he had been, Dick Howard had been commissioned by the new church president, Wallace B. Smith,
to study the issue of polygamy and report to the first presidency. Now, Wallace B. was the first Smith president who wasn't committed to his great-grandfather not being polygamous. So when church historian Dick Howard presented a paper to the first presidency, it was published then in this John Weber Journal after considerable discussion by church leaders and a lot of editing, which was done largely by Alan Tyree, who is now in the first presidency. When Howard's paper was published in 1983, I think the fact that Dick, the church historian and a popular guy, the fact that he was suggesting that maybe Joseph was a polygamist really helped a lot of people in the church to say, well, you know, maybe he was. And I think Dick Howard's publishing of that paper is kind of a watershed moment in the church as far as our attitude toward polygamy. Our next church historian, Mark Shearer, published the first volume of his three-volume history of the church in 2013, 26 years after Dick Howard's John Whitmer paper. By this time, there was a lot more acceptance in the church of the possibility that Joseph had been engaged in polygamy. Shearer was quite clear on the matter, even suggesting that Joseph's polygamy would today be regarded as ministerial abuse. Shearer's history had been commissioned by the first presidency, and they gave the approval to publish it. The community of Christ today, in these recent years, does not take a position on a historical matter. They leave that for historians to debate, and we can all decide which of the historians we think is the most accurate. Okay, it was a whole different church than what I'd grown up in. But number four, does lineage in succession to the office of church president make any sense? Well, I'll be brief on this because time is kind of running out. It doesn't. I wrote an editorial in Courage, a journal we had way back in the 70s, saying, you know, we've debated with the Mormons which is the best method of succession in the presidency. They got that seniority in the 12 thing, and we got this lineage, Smith lineage. The question is not which one is best. The question is which one is worse. We should resume the debates on polygamy with the Mormons and just exchange notes, and that would probably work out just fine. So anyway, I won't deal with that any longer, but I think both is just incredible, and we see that now as far as lineage. The Remnant Church, one of our splinter groups, they had a Fred Larson, who some of our people have met out here in Utah because he's come out here several times, like at least to Mormon history meetings, and really nice guy. Well, he died about a month or so ago. And the church, they had no direct descent. Fred had one son, I think, but he wasn't in the church. He's got a nephew named Lachlan Mackay, but he seems to be satisfied in the community of Christ as an apostle. So that's not going to bring Locke over there. So anyway, it just makes no sense. You've got such a completely narrowing bunch of eligible presidents. As time goes on. So, issue number three, should women be ordained in the Christian ministry? When our World Conference in 1984 accepted a new policy that women should be ordained, about 20% of the delegates voted against the motion by President Wallace B. Smith, that Wallace B. Smith should be accepted as a revelation and placed in the Doctrine and Covenants as Section 156. It led to a major schism in the church. Over the next few years, at least 20% of the active church members left the church, many of them joining various separatist groups in the church. I see no rational reason to oppose women being eligible for ordination on the same basis as men. It seems to be simply tradition based on a long history of patriarchal societies where men were the rulers and wrote the rules, including writing in the Bible, stuff that reinforced the power of men. Women are, on average, more nurturant than men. Women in America seem to be more spiritual than men. There is evidence to support this. They go to church more frequently. They pray more frequently. Maybe there should be more women in the priesthood than men. Or if we're going to have a one-sex-only priesthood, make it the women. So anyway, we... we got through that crisis, and women are ordained now. And I'll shorten it a little bit. And now, I shouldn't put this down too soon. Now, number two, this issue number two. Should baptism be a sacrament conferring membership in a denomination, or is it a sacrament affirming a commitment to Jesus? It was pretty common in our congregation to have one or more members come to church regularly in that congregation, take regular duties in the congregation, but not be members of the church, and never, maybe over a decade, got to take the communion, and yet they're valuable members of that local church. And so as time went on, we got more and more concerned that we should not limit baptism to those who happen to be members of the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. After all, we were a very small denomination to begin with, so we're the only ones who can legitimately have the authority to take the communion. As this went by, this bothered more and more people, and so finally we adopted open communion, where we'll accept those of you who are LDS. I'm not making this as a missionary pitch, but just as those of you who are LDS, if you decide to join the RLDS church, what you need to do is we would accept your LDS baptism, and that's baptism into Christ, and then you could have the sacrament of confirmation to make you a member of the church. So baptism into Christ, confirmation as a part of this group now. So I think that worked out fine. Okay, issue number one. Should LGBT people be eligible for priesthood and the sacrament of marriage on the same basis as for other men and women? We often don't realize how we accept irrational things as a given because they are so embedded in our culture. As I look back on my life, I can rightfully conclude that given my family, my church, and the communities I was reared in, I was raised racist, sexist, anti-Catholic, anti-Semitic, and homophobic. I was a perfect candidate for a position in the Trump administration. The most serious prejudices for me, whoops, that's what I wanted. I wanted to take a little drink. I think I will take a moment here. Okay. The most serious prejudices for me were homophobia, racism, and sexism in that order. My view is that we learn these poisonous prejudices from our community, and they are deeply embedded in our being. And the only way we can overcome them is if we realize that we have probably never fully overcome them. So our job is to do all we can to reduce them as much as we can, but we probably will never totally get rid of them. Thus, we don't have to get defensive if someone says, well, hey, what you just said, Russell, what you just said in class was homophobic or racist or sexist. We can say, okay, let's have a talk. Let's talk about it. And maybe they'll convince you, yeah, Russell, you hadn't thought about that. That really was. So now in the racism class I taught at Graceland, I'd often have somebody say, now I'm not a racist, but, you probably all heard this, I'm not a racist, but, usually within about two or three sentences, they'd approve that they are racist. So it was really... now the other, just this is proof too of how good those kinds of denials are. Just three or four days ago, our great president of the United States assured us that he was the least racist person in the country. No, I'm sorry, in the world. Yeah, that's the people don't tell the truth when they're talking about their own racism. But the scientific information is strong on the side that homosexuality is not a choice, but is either present at birth or in the first year or two of life. And so, but in the Hebrew Bible, we read that homosexual acts are an abomination and thus should be put to death. Are you a fundamentalist, a literalist, believes every word in the Bible? You can't. You just can't do that. Sorry. And we should, we just can't see the Bible as infallible. In 1999, my wife, Lois, and I attended a retreat held in Chicago by the GALA organization, Gay and Lesbian Acceptance. When we walked in that door, we soon would meet about a half dozen of the brightest students I've ever had, who are among the nicest people I've ever known. If these fine people are destined for eternity in hell, then hell is where I want to be. So for me, I mean, there's no way I cannot accept this people totally. So for me, both rational study as well as human experience lead me to the conclusion that gay, lesbian, transgender people are deserving of love and respect and priesthood office and marriage as much as anybody else. Lois and I were delighted when delegates at our USA National Conference in 2013 were proud to be part of a conference that decided to accept GLBT people as worthy of priesthood callings and sacrament of marriage on the same basis as other folks. And the votes on the two issues had been between 75 and 80% of the delegates in support of these two measures. In my view, fundamentalists and conservative Christians don't teach us how to think, they teach us what to think. So I see human reason as a major force in the changes that went on in the church. About three times I've been guest on one of those weekly religious talk shows in Salt Lake City radio. One time a woman called in and said, "What makes you think you can differ with a prophet?" My response, "Because God gave me a brain." Now, I didn't say it was a good one, but he gave me a brain. So that's those are my 10 commandments. I mean, 10 reasons. And so we got about 16 minutes, I guess. I thought it was a little bit.
We have a little over 15 minutes for questions. Once again, since we're recording the session, please come up and use the microphone.
Hi, thank you. That was a really engaging talk. Do you know if there was any movement from RLDS into Mormon fundamentalism at that time when members of the church were basically deciding to accept Joseph Smith's polygamy as historic fact? And, you know, I just imagine kind of the more conservatively minded folks may have been drawn to it at that time.
Clearly, some of the more conservative RLDS people who couldn't accept Section 156 became Mormons. I mean, there's hundreds of them, like 200 around the Independence area itself. And some good friends of mine, one of my best friends among my students, Bob Hutchins, became a Mormon. But anyway, I don't know of any who didn't just go into regular Mormon activities. Bob is still, after 30 some years now, a member, still active, still solid, still appreciates that he left our church and joined theirs. So yeah, there was a natural tendency, but I don't know of anybody who went all the way to fundamentalism. I mean, to our fundamentalism, not your fundamentalism. I mean, not LDS fundamentalism, but we got to always remember, RLDS use fundamentalism in a way that the rest of society, except for the Mormons, use it. And the Mormons have their special polygamy thing. But anyway, no, that's my answer as far as I know.
So are you active in your church? And two, are you do you consider yourself a believer?
Yeah. I would not be active in the church if they had not made these changes. There's no doubt about that. I was very dissatisfied in the 1970s. I felt like I'm only still in the church because I'm teaching at Graceland, and we had a nice congregation as well as a Graceland congregation. So it was a good system, a good situation at Graceland. And we had campus ministers like Roy Saville and Lloyd Young and others on down the line who were more when Everett Graffio was campus minister in 1978 to 80, he just opened the communion to everybody. He said, "This is Graceland. We're 70% RLDS, but we have 30% non, and I want them all to be part of this campus congregation, and you all can take the communion." Now, he didn't make a big public issue of it, but he quietly told the priesthood, "Serve it to everybody. That as they reach out their hand, don't pull it away like it happened in the past sometimes." So, yeah.
So, my understanding is that the view of the Bible has changed from assuming that things were written with the intent that they should be read metaphorically, mm-hmm. to assuming that they were assumed to be literal and just not true, mm-hmm. which opens up possibilities for Joseph Smith too. But mm-hmm. Maybe it's a subtle difference. But yeah. Has the Communion of Christ followed that change in seeing it? Do you see what I mean?
Not particularly. Now, I'll finish answering the other question, and then I'll answer yours, because I really didn't finish the other. I am very active in the church. I'm an elder in the Lamoni congregation. I'm an active elder. I preach kind of when my turn comes, which is only about once a year since we have a large enough congregation. But I've taught Sunday school classes, and I've been on several World Church Commissions, the Commission on Racism, the Commission on Human Rights, and one or two others. I'm quite active in the church, but I wouldn't be if we hadn't made most or all of these changes, because I just couldn't handle the religion that I was raised in. Now, yours. I'd say our view on the Bible is just interpret the Bible, each document in the Bible, in the context in which it was written. So some are clearly fiction, the great story of Jonah, for example, and some are at least attempts to be history. And there are many of them that you've got to look at the internal evidence to see that Daniel didn't really write back in whatever century that was, but he wrote about the second century and so forth. So now, we just follow the biblical critical type of perspective, but the thing you were suggesting, I've never heard of in our church. So, anybody else?
So one thing that has been happening is, declines of liberal and mainline religions, yeah. And conservatives have said it's because once you get rid of those strict rules, then there's no reason for anyone to be religious. And as even you mentioned, the ordination of women in the RLDS, Community of Christ, did result in people leaving, and various traditions are considering accepting LGBT relationships, accepting LGBT clergy, and it's causing schisms and all that kind of stuff. So, and as well, people who leave conservative religions because they don't like the conservatism and they don't like the anti-LGBT, anti-women. They don't seem to be joining other religions. They seem to be becoming nuns, as the researchers would say. Yeah. So what would you say your thoughts on this as you've kind of discussed this transition in RLDS to Community of Christ? Do you think that it's kind of following that same trajectory of liberal churches kind of just fall apart? Or do you think that there's a way of turning that around?
Well, yeah, I think there's a way of turning it around. I certainly don't know. It very well might not happen. It may be that the church, like a lot of other liberal churches, are sort of heading downhill toward death if they don't find some way to regenerate something. But I think we have such the things we say in church and the mission statements and so forth that we have are so unlike the old days when we had basically the Articles of Faith was our creed. I think it's worth calling it a creed back until about the 1970s or 80s. I think we're really striving to be a peace church, trying to work on poverty, build community. We're not really like the Methodists or the Presbyterians or the. We have a lot of the same beliefs, but our focus is on these mission initiatives and so forth. So I think there's always a possibility that we'll get a whole different kind of convert in the church, and if so, the church will be a heck of a lot better than it ever was before. So the other thing I'd say is, to those, I've heard this said ever since a guy named Kelly wrote a book back in the 1960s about the conservative churches are growing faster. My point is just simply, I want to follow what seems to be the truth and not some myth that seems to be drawing a lot of people. Donald Trump has, sorry to be political again, but Donald Trump has about 35 or 40% of people following his fake news, believing his fake news. Well, I'm sorry, even leave Trump out of it. I'm not going to be involved in some movement that's based on lies or myths that are conscientiously understood and followed by good people. But they're just not true. Our creed is supposedly all truth. Well, that's what I want. Anybody else? There's somebody.
Thank you for your presentation. It was very informative. Again, I would recommend to the audience, if they didn't hear your interview with Carla Long on the Project Zion podcast, to check it out. They talk in depth about women in the priesthood. I enjoyed that. I enjoyed your 10 bullet points today. As far as women in the priesthood and people deciding to fragment and I liked your comment just now about do what's right, let the consequence follow from an LDS hymn growing up, right? I think that And also the comment just now that is growth going to be found by trying to pander, or is it to try to do what is right? And I appreciate your comment as far as you saying that you wouldn't want to be in a church where prejudice is celebrated, and and that at a church you should try to learn integrity. Mm-hmm. So thank you very much for your comments.
And we had plenty of struggles with racial prejudice, especially back in the 60s and before. But yeah, so we got a little bit of time left. Mm-hmm. Of course, Ryan. Former student, he took my Community of Christ history, so he's well qualified for Sunstone. And he got an A.
Thank God.
He was an outstanding student and an outstanding guy.
So thank you for your points. A lot has changed in RLDS Community of Christ in the last 40 years, looking back, 1980 to 2020. Mm-hmm. And several of those points take place within that 40-year time frame. Yeah. Can you comment on what may be driving that change? If it's more than just reason, but mm-hmm. we've been talking about postmodernism throughout this conference. We've been talking, are we just listening to the divine differently? Just some comments on why the rapid changes in just a small amount of time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, a big reason is, and I hate to say this because I think we give far too much power to the prophet, and you guys do too, but I mean you guys over here. The change from W. Wallace Smith to his son Wallace B. Smith was like night and day. W. Wallace Smith thought Martin Luther King was a communist. I wrote editorials in the Saints Herald on Selma and on Birmingham and so forth. The presidency would call our editor, Paul Wellington, over. Well, they had regular meetings, but at these regular meetings, they'd say, you need to kind of try to sit on that Bill Russell. He's offending some of the saints, especially down south. And Paul would come back, and he'd tell me what they said, and then we wouldn't do anything about it. I continued to write the same editorial. Paul never took a sentence out of an editorial of mine. He certainly never rejected an editorial of mine. So we just kept on doing what we thought was right. But anyway, Wellington came back from one of these. He said, Wallace Smith thinks Martin Luther King is a communist. And he said, and he also thinks you're a communist. I said, well, to be in Martin Luther King's company is wonderful. I mean, I'm delighted about that. And then 17 years later, I had a talk with Morris Draper, who was of the First Presidency, one of Wally's counsel, one of W. Wallace's counsel, all 20 years of his presidency. And I told him about it. I said, I understand Wallace B. thought King was a communist. And Draper said, well, worse than that, he thought King was a common criminal, and he thought that he had no idea, he had no comprehension of this whole idea of conscientious civil disobedience, that you break the law, but then you're willing to go to jail, except whatever. John Lewis went to jail over 40 times. You willingly go to jail, accept the punishment as a witness against the unjust law that you've broken. So anyway, Wallace, he wrote an editorial in the Herald in 1962, which basically supported racial segregation in public schools. He didn't say it directly, but it's there. Well, anyway, his son comes in 1978, medical doctor, and one of the first questions that comes up is, well, how about homosexuality? I mean, we've got a pretty quaint and not very good official statement on homosexuality. And President Smith, Wallace B., said, well, maybe that's the way you should study it. Maybe we should allow gay marriage. Maybe we should provide a sacramental service for it. Let's go ahead and study the matter and see if that's something we should do. Well, there was enough objection that they backed off, but they did make a slightly improved statement. Dick Howard asked to study the issue of polygamy. His dad had been strongly opposed to polygamy. No way he would have ever entertained something like this. And Dick does this study. And so Wally B. takes it to the First Presidency of the Council of 12 in a meeting, and they read it. Some of the guys didn't like it, but others thought it was pretty good. And Wallace says, well, let's publish it. but let's don't publish it in the Saints Herald, you know, the official publication. How about that independent John Wimber Historical Association journal? Maybe they'll print it for us. And so they asked Claire Vlahos, the editor, would you be willing to publish Dick Howard's article? And Claire said, sure. And so we published in the John Wimber Journal. So anyway, it was just a whole different approach by Wallace B. Smith. He took 2 years of study with St. Paul faculty and others to get ready for this job, which was, and really his thinking changed quite a bit overnight, over those 2 years. So he was just radically different than his father. And so since so often it was a matter of the young scholars publishing ideas, and Wally B., you know, the president of the church or the first presidency just gradually accepts it. And so that's how change often happened. So I don't like the method, but I like the outcome of Wallace B. Smith in the presidency. I mean, he even liked my articles. I mean, so he has to be a good guy. I mean, he cited one thing he wrote, articles that really influenced him, and he ran off about six names. And I was one of them. So I think he liked me better than his father did. He thought I was a communist. So we got about 1 or 2 minutes, three minutes left. Okay.
What's the communion of confirmation? What's involved
in that? A sacrament of confirmation? Yeah, well, it's just the person who's been baptized, in this case, in the church. They just typically sit down in the chair, and usually two men confirm them. One person is the spokesperson. And
with hands.
Yeah, with hands, and Now, when Wallace B. Smith was...
Women now, too.
Yeah, women do that, too.
Oh, yeah, sorry about that, yeah. When Grant McMurray, the first non-Smith president of the church, when he was ordained, there were like ten hands on his head. One of them was Barbara Howard, a well-known historian, but I think she was the only woman. The others were kind of the logical church leaders, you know, that had their hands on. And his buddy from his youth in Canada, a guy who comes up with John Whitmer meetings regularly, Bryce Taylor. Anyway, other questions, comments? We haven't had any rebuttals. We haven't had any rotten tomatoes or anything like that. So I don't know what's the matter. So
No, I don't have any tomatoes. I'm unarmed. You were asked if you considered yourself a believer.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I believe in the RLDS, in the community of Christ as it exists today. And that doesn't mean I believe in everything it does, everything it says. There's an incompetence that comes out of independence from time to time, as you guys are kind of aware of out here. But we've got people out there doing great, great work. I believe in the system we have now. And I believe in Jesus. I'm not a big person on the Christ in the sense of all those historic theological pronouncements of the Middle Ages, or the confessions of Nicaea and so forth. I used to kind of really enjoy reading about those, but they don't mean anything to me anymore. I believe in Jesus. And then the four Gospels are the heart of my canon of Scripture. The four Gospels, the letters of Paul will be next, and the other New Testament writings. Some of the prophets, Isaiah, Amos, Hosea, some others. Some of the wisdom of literature. The law of the first five books and the history books. There's too much garbage in those. No bastard shall enter the assembly of the Lord until the tenth generation thereof. Well, I'm a bastard then, because my Welsh descendant was about six generations from me, and public records show he was a bastard. So I've got my own canon. I think we all do. We all have some aspects of our scripture we like, they're really important, and others we just assume they never were added to the canon. So, one final question or nothing?
No, we really don't have time.
Well, thank you very much.